Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com or you will find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up, the Association of Occupational Therapists of Ireland held their annual conference in Carlow in September, and three of those awarded for their work on the night will join me in studio in just a bit. I'll also be joined by psychologist Alison Keating, who'll be talking about her latest book, It's All Too Much, with practical advice on managing anxiety and panic attacks. And coach and speaker Georgie Durkin on how to keep well in winter. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, it's been a good week, busy but great. The number one thing I have to say that people say to me is how busy I am. And based on my Instagram of me going here and there, it certainly looks that way. But I assure you, there is always plenty of downtime in between. I always prioritise replenishing my energy. And I do love what I do, heading from this show to an event, talking about winter wellness and learning from other experts. It's not that tough, really, is it? I was in Cork for the Club Female Founder Awards on Friday, and I love meeting people who had an idea, a passion, and they went for it. Now, I don't by any means think less of anyone who gets by and does what they need to do to put food on the table, but it can be exciting to meet a bunch of entrepreneurs, especially those in a network who are up for sharing their knowledge and ideas with each other. And do you know what? It was great crack. I gave a talk on burnout, and no one is immune to it. We can easily find ourselves on a treadmill of life, pushing through and never stopping. It can happen to carers, parents, students, as well as workers or business owners. I'm sure I've spoken about it on the show before, but it's worth being reminded that while we often identify burnout as exhaustion and an inability to engage in life, that part actually comes at the very end. It's important to bear in mind that the initial stages include a need to prove oneself, self-doubt, negative self-talk, and neglecting your own self-care. Taking time to fill our own cup back up helps us to be better workers, better parents, business owners, and carers. It's actually a necessity more than a luxury. As the saying goes, if you don't start minding your health, you will be forced to mind your illness. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, Georgie Durkin is a motivational speaker, a coach, and a meditation teacher. She joins me in studio now to talk winter wellness. Georgie, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here.
What should people be thinking about when it comes to looking after their health and well-being into winter?
Okay, well, the darkness really does affect us and it affects our moods and it affects and changes how we want to move through our day. So we'll notice we feel different. And it's really important on the darker days to bring as much light in as you possibly can. So obviously we can't make the sun go for longer and make the days brighter, but we can try and bring some brightness into our day that really can lift our moods and really help us actually just enjoy the winter, because it shouldn't be dreaded and it can be a really lovely, lovely time. It can help us to slow down. It can help us to really reflect on our life and take a stock of it and have a little evaluation, as I always say, like just like businesses at the end of the year audit their year and look back on the year and look at what they've achieved and what went right and what didn't go right and what they need to change. We really have this time now to actually slow down and look at our year and go, what went right? What am I proud of? What have I done that I really want to celebrate? What do I want to change next year? What do I maybe want to focus on? What's important for me? Because we learn things as we move through the year that we might need to change, that we might need to adapt, that aren't working for us anymore, that don't feel in alignment with our values. And the winter is a time to really just take stock, to really reflect, maybe slow down, do things that you wouldn't do in the summer, take more time to read, to cozy up, to spend time with people indoors, to slow down and actually have conversations and not be going to so many different things because the days are shorter. So you want to have that natural instinct to kind of go inwards, but also bringing more light into your day through the things that you do. So know what brings light into your life. Is it meeting a certain person and having a great chat? Is curling up with a book and peace and drinking a cup of tea? Is it going for a walk out in nature and seeing the crisp the leaves and the smells? And is that a light in your life? What lights you up? What brings life force into your life? It's like plugging that plug in and bringing that light on and turning it on. What turns your light on? And so you can do that for yourself. It doesn't matter on the weather. It doesn't matter what's going on in the world. It doesn't matter whether it's darker physically or darker stories that you're listening to. You can actually switch the light on. That is within your power. So it's knowing firstly, and that's the hard part, actually taking time to look at what brings light into my life. We never really stop to actually ask that. We go along with what other people are doing, what we think we should do.
What we're not doing. We often just berate ourselves all of the time.
As I always say, focus on the have done list rather than the list you haven't done. So look at all the things you've done this year that you're proud of, that bring light and happiness to you, rather than focusing on all the things you haven't done. And that's really important as you go into Christmas and you see the big list of things you have to do. Look at the things you have done. Look at the things you're doing every day. Acknowledge them, celebrate them.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that we do lean into the seasons. Like obviously in the summer when the days are longer, you can decide at 8 o'clock to go and meet friends and go for a walk and do all of those things. Whereas now as it starts to get dark at 4 o'clock, you naturally start to gravitate to getting cozy, getting warm. The food we're attracted to is obviously different. It's going from the kind of the salads and maybe the smaller meals into nice cozy meals and lean into that. I think leaning into that rest cozy period is really nice. And you mentioned the Christmas word there, and the hype machine starts now, but I am thinking, or I am hearing from a lot of people, how keen they are to put up their Christmas decorations because there is a really warm, cozy feeling that comes from them.
Well, it actually, you know, smell and sights and sounds trigger feelings in our body. And if Christmas is a happy, joyful time for you, putting the lights up and the Christmas lights, it brings light into your life. It brings joy. Do it. It doesn't matter if someone says you shouldn't do it or you should do it. It's the same as I see people, I'm in Greystones and everyone's in sea swimming and it's like, but if it doesn't bring you joy or light you up, don't do it. It's like, do really what brings you joy and what brings you light. Like this is a season that gives different things than the summer. It's different. It's not better or worse. It's different. And if you can suck the joy out of it in whatever way that is for you, do it, because your body is actually telling you what it needs. Just the same as in the gym or if you're training, the training is really important, but the rest and recovery is. You won't be able to keep going if you don't take that rest and recovery. And nature is telling us what we're naturally designed to do. We just don't listen to ourselves. We don't listen to our bodies. We think we should be doing the same thing every day, all year round, you know, and your body actually doesn't want to eat the same thing every day. But if we actually tuned in and took time to actually listen, go, what do I feel like today? What is my body looking for? Is it needing a bit more rest today? Instead of always using the word should, I think that's very telling. If you find yourself constantly saying, I should, I should, I should, I should, that's going to feel very stressful because you're not doing it from a place of choice. You're doing it from a place of should, and that's out of fear, and that creates stress in the body. It's like the body's going, I don't want to do this, but I should do it. So it's pushing against its natural rhythm.
Or even sometimes if you flip it from saying, I have to go to a walk for a walk to I get to go for a walk, you know, and it just takes the pressure off. Mm-hmm. And you're right, eke out what is right for you, be it the sea swim, be it the gym, be it the walk, what's your thing, and then kind of say I choose to do it as opposed to I have to. And even if Christmas is a really positive time for people, it can still get on top of you because there's lots of meetups, there's work things, you're trying to wind down work, there's a lot on the to-do list. And I'm conscious as well, for some people, there can be financial strain, there can be family strain. What's your advice to people to try and keep themselves and their foundation as strong as possible through all the madness?
I think it's really important to listen to how you're talking to yourself and the pressure that you might be putting yourself under. Is it coming from you or is it coming from others? And reminding yourself that you can only do your best. And your best might be to just do one thing on your list. I really think it's important actually this time of year though to make lists, to get the thoughts out of your head and onto paper. Because when they're swirling around your head, you're your own worst enemy because you're constantly going around and around. I must remember to do that, I have to do that, I have to do that. Put it down on paper and then say, I can only do my best today. So what do I actually have to do today? What could maybe wait? What, you know, what could I ask someone for help with? Do I really need to do that? Is that really important? Does that matter to me? Is there someone else, as I said, that could do that for me? And just saying, reminding yourself, I can just do my best today. That's all I can do. And that's enough. And it's our own self-talk, especially women. We can be our own worst enemies, you know, putting that pressure. No one else is telling us we have to do all these things. We're telling ourselves. So it's really kind of becoming a bit aware of, could I be kinder to myself? Could I have a bit more compassion? Could I have a bit more peace inside me and joy and bring actually to this season, maybe do it differently than I do it every year? And realizing the world won't fall apart. And what matters to me? What matters to my family? What matters? Is it really this? Like questioning. Questioning is really good. It's healthy.
Yeah, because like you said, we think we have to do the same thing day in, day out. And we think we have to do the same thing every festive mm-hmm. season. And I've certainly paired it way back mm-hmm. with the meetups, with the gifting. You know, and I've heard from other friends, they're not meeting before Christmas. They're going to, you know, get together in January when mm-hmm. things are a little bit more boring and it's something to look forward to. I know a lot of people aren't doing the big dinner in the same way. They're pairing it back and cooking something different. Ask the question, and putting up a boundary and saying no is a really healthy and positive thing to do.
I often say that no is sometimes the most loving response. And actually, you know, you notice a lot when people say, actually, does anyone want to cook a turkey? And people look at me and go, oh, thank God you said it, because actually nobody likes turkey. We'd much prefer to have some tapas or something. And people are actually doing that now. Or what I notice a lot, and you see a lot in the magazines and the papers, is people going to a hotel for two nights and getting someone else to cook for them because they actually don't enjoy it at all. So I'm going, who are you doing it for? Like questioning, does anyone? And it's always that, oh, thank God someone said it, because actually we were just waiting for someone to say, why don't we do it differently this year? Or none of us actually enjoy this. Why are we doing it? Because someone told us we should do it this way. It's really important that we learn and grow and evolve and change as humans. We're that's natural. So we might not want to do the things we did 10 years ago because we're different. So
yeah,
it's okay.
And all that said, you know, it can be mania. And I think they're the times we lean on our wellness practices mm-hmm. all the more, because we can throw them out and say, I don't have time to do breath work, meditation, the walk, whatever it is that keeps you sane, to make sure I'm cooking a home meal, to sit down for my meals. We throw all that out. And it's when we're really busy is when we need it most.
Yes. And I am in everything I teach and events or retreats or one-to-one sessions, I always, like, I'm a mom of twins, I have a business partners, family, all of that. I'm not about sitting on a meditation cushion for an hour. I'm about bringing simple practices into your daily life, and they're minutes. They are moments of connecting to yourself, just being present. That could be 1 minute sitting in your car and just consciously closing your eyes and taking some deep breaths and maybe going, you know, as I breathe in, I let go of stress and I breathe in peace. Breathing in peace, letting go of stress. It can be simple as that. And you'll actually notice a difference in a minute. It's maybe going for a walk. They're not the fancy things. They're often the very simple, but they create momentum. So if you're doing them every day, it's the times when you're really stressed that you notice that it's paying off, because you actually don't react the same way, or you don't get as overwhelmed, or you can move through it a little bit more easily. So you'll still get angry, you'll still get stressed, you'll still get, but you can actually find a way out of that more quickly. You don't get as in it. So it's the simple things, but it's the difficulty for people is knowing what feels right for them. What's their joy list? I always say, make a joy list, pin it up on your fridge or your notice board or somewhere you see it. And for December or November, actually all year round, but especially this time, pick at least one thing off that list and do it every single day. And that can be as simple as sitting with a cup of tea and a good book for 10 minutes in the morning before the rest of the house wakes. It sets your whole foundation up for the day. And it's not that you won't get cross or cranky. It's that you'll find it won't be as intense.
I heard it described really well. I was at an event this week with the psychotherapist Siobhan Murray, and she said, we don't save the brushing of the teeth and say, I'll do 2 hours at the weekend and I just won't bother during the week. We do it for 2 minutes in the morning and 2 minutes in the evening. And that's what sets up our oral hygiene. It's the same for managing our stress levels. Tiny little steps make the biggest difference. Incredible advice. Thank you so, so much. If you want to find out more about Georgie's work, you can go to georgiedurkin.com. Georgie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, I'll be meeting three incredible occupational therapists who recently won awards for their work.
Alive and kicking. on News Talk.
Now, you're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, occupational therapy helps people to do the everyday things that they want to do or need to do when faced with maybe illness, injury or a disability. The Association of Occupational Therapists of Ireland held their annual conference in Carlow earlier this year, and three of those awarded for their work on the night join me in studio now. I have Sarah Quinn, Assistant Professor in the Discipline of Occupational Therapy in Trinity College Dublin, Leonie Boland, Clinical Specialist Occupational Therapist with the HSE Programme for the Homeless, Dublin North City Mental Health Service, and Miriam Creenan, who is Senior Occupational Therapist with the Children's Disability Network Team in Kilkenny. Well, you are all very welcome.
Thank you, Claire.
Thank you.
I might start, Sarah and Leonie, with you two, because you were awarded as a pair. So, Leonie, maybe you tell me a little bit about the initiative you worked on together.
Perfect. So as occupational therapist, I work to support people to sort of participate in everyday life. So for people who have experience of homelessness and experience of mental health difficulties, sort of build back routine, time use to give a sense of meaning and purpose as they transition from homelessness. And regularly becoming a volunteer or doing voluntary work is one of those goals. So to support people with sort of more complex needs, I wanted to be able to support them in practice, in the doing. So about working, partnering the person with experience of homelessness with a student, for them to volunteer together as partners, as equals, to be able to go out for a period of time to volunteer in a charity shop over a number of weeks. So we were really lucky to be able to partner with Sarah and the students in Trinity and Vision Ireland the people that I work with, to be able to volunteer for over 6 weeks initially with training and a meet and greet session, and then for a second period of time in the second semester Trinity to volunteer for 12 weeks for them to embed and build their confidence in working and volunteering in a role in a charity shop.
And is this like a possible dress rehearsal for getting a job, or is it the power of giving back and being involved and community?
To be clear, it's all of those things. I think that was one of the things people want to give back, especially people who've used services themselves. They want to give back, and yet homelessness can actually take away a person's confidence, their ability to see their own skills. So we were able to, through doing together and them having that opportunity, yes, they built skills to be able to think about future things. So I know one gentleman was delighted when he got a CV because he's now thinking about part-time work, the role of volunteering for that. But also for other people in a world when you're trying to find a sense of purpose and meaning. And what can you do? So having, for one gentleman, even having that 2 hours of volunteering in a week is a really meaningful purpose and a role for him to see an identity beyond homelessness and mental health.
Because you'd imagine days, you know, just roll one into the other. So to even have, this is my working day, this is the time, this is when I come in, this is the bus I get. These are things so many of us take for granted and probably even moan about, but they can be a real gift for meaning and purpose in life.
Absolutely. And I think there's something really nice that it's outside of particularly clinical as well. So it's not with me as the OT, although I'm behind the scenes making sure it can happen, but it's about them volunteering as a volunteer in the shop with students who are volunteering and people who are retiring who are volunteering. So it's really purposeful in that way. And then I think Sarah will talk about the value of having the students as well, partnering in that.
And tell us a bit about the students then, Sarah. What sort of feedback were you getting from them?
Yeah, thanks, Claire. Well, the students in Trinity, we have in occupational therapy in first and second year, we have a course that is delivered through community engaged learning, which means essentially that students need to get out and learn in and with the community. But the basis of community-based learning is that they deliver and provide meaningful community service. So while the students learn loads, it has to address a community need as well. So there has to be this reciprocity. So the partnership between student and community needs to be win-win on both sides. So it needs to be gains. So from my end, like Leonie's just talked about some of the gains from the service user's point of view, but from my end with the students, all of the students who partake in this, you know, increase in confidence. They have to take on quite a bit of responsibility and take initiative. So that also improves their communication skills. But quite importantly, I think, is that they see themselves as an agent of change, maybe now, that they recognise how important participation is for for people to address issues of social inequality, to build social cohesion. Participation in the community is really important, and they're kind of empowering that. They're supporting people to engage. So there's a huge amount of learning in that piece alone.
And that's a much better way to learn, isn't it? I mean, I think you were given the impression, and perhaps traditionally it was, you know, learn the theory, do the exams and the assignments, and then out into the wider world. Whereas to combine the two makes a lot more sense.
Well, yeah. And I guess they have clinical placements later on in their academic course. But we position this course in first and second year. It runs right across the whole academic year, but we position it ideally before they go out in clinical practice, so they begin to see people as people and they're developing relationships with people. So while in the background we're doing a lot of theory and, you know, discussing occupational therapy concepts, then they're seeing kind of this is not just the practical application, but it's beginning to make sense to them, how we talk about people. But first and foremost, they see the person, they develop a relationship, and they don't see a deficit, a problem. First off, they see a person with a whole history, a whole life. And I think that is an important part of our course, I think, and why we position it, you know, where we do.
Important in the area of homelessness to be breaking down those stigmas and barriers and that negativity bias that perhaps we all carry. Yeah. And the students reported that they had improvements in their own self-confidence, that they became more aware of their own vulnerabilities and strengths, as well as that partnership and that equality with the people they were working with.
Well, because our students are from all over Ireland, and they may not know the city, and they may not know certainly the charity shops. And so I think they learnt that, yes, they were good at turning up on time and being punctual and being organised and making the phone call to introduce themselves. Mind you, they might have died doing that, because even that is, you know, tricky enough for 18, 19-year-olds to make a call to a charity shop. But they also began to recognise the skills that the person they're with brought, who were great at, they knew the area, they knew how to chit-chat with local people, you know, especially when they were on, you know, in their local stomping ground. And meeting, you know, fellow other people who are maybe homeless, maybe not, or, you know, I think the students recognised in that everybody has not just a place, but everybody can give, everybody has skills, you know, and we can all learn from each other.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely love that. I want to bring you in, Miriam. You were awarded the Eve Duggan Award. Tell us a bit about the project that was highlighting.
Yeah, so just to give you a little bit of background about the Eva Duggan Award. Eva Duggan was a paediatric occupational therapist who advanced paediatric occupational therapy for the profession. And you might remember Christy Brown. She was Christy Brown's occupational therapist and helped to support him to be included in educational settings by making a seatbelt so he could travel on the bus. So that was back in the day. Mm-hmm. So thankfully, we are continuing to advance the profession in paediatric occupational therapy. So my award is titled Sensory Oral Hygiene Practices for Children with Sensory Processing Challenges. So currently I work on a Children's Disability Network team under Enable Ireland in Kilkenny, and I work with many children who have significant sensory processing difficulties related to maybe an autistic brain or a neurodivergent brain or past adverse childhood experiences. So the reason I thought of this project is I worked in a large national University of California Children's Services in San Francisco, and I worked with many children in both the neonatal intensive care unit and on regular units that had sensory processing difficulties. And I saw how important early positive experience and early intervention can really impact a child's functioning and be able to help them in the long term. So that was the reason why I chose this as a forward-moving intervention to help children progress, to be able to gain the skills to be able to brush their teeth for positive oral hygiene outcomes, for positive dental care and well-being in the future.
And how is it going to work, or is it individual for each child?
Yeah, so that's a really great question, Claire. So we have a large client base in our network. So it's very difficult to provide direct one-on-one intervention for a child. So this project is more parent coaching led. So I've developed webinars and in-person parent workshops to teach them strategies on how they can support their child to be able to address oral hygiene practices at home. So it's a very sequential approach and a very step-by-step approach. And it starts wherever the child is in their journey, we'll say, of developing oral hygiene practices.
Amazing. And in their own home with people that know them best, giving on your expertise. And that's a really brilliant way of targeting it. Otherwise, you know, it might be more difficult to reach so many. Now, your project is just in its infancy, but this award is a real boost for it, isn't it?
It is, because we now have some tools. We have a little bit of a bursary to help fund some of the tools that can help support the families with their child. So even like tools that are kind of basic, odorless, tasteless toothpaste can be really effective tool that a child can use, that it's not an adverse reaction in their mouth. Even looking at different types of toothbrushes, whether it's a three-sided toothbrush with three-sided bristles or an electric toothbrush, can be a really effective tool that can help to support them.
Amazing. And what about yourselves, Sarah and Leonie? What does this award mean to this project?
Well, I think it's given it some recognition. Community engaged learning is already very much embedded in our curriculum, but this has formalised our relationship so that they're definitely one of our partners for the students.
And it's lovely, the Anne Beckett Award is about acknowledging a sort of occupation-based, like practical projects that enhance the lives of people. So it's lovely to get that award in particular, just to see the difference it made for the people and the students who've participated in it.
Yeah.
And I think it's great to hear the three of you discuss, you know, occupational therapy and what it is, and allowing people to do everyday tasks. Because I think there can be confusion around who it's for and what it is. Mm-hmm. It can be confusing.
I mean, I think it can, because it can work across so many health and social care areas. And I think that's what can actually sometimes make it a little bit more confusing. But at the core of it, it's about supporting people to participate in everyday life, to do the things that they want to, need to, be able to do. And of course, I suppose in life, whether that's perhaps some traumatic injury, or where that's a sort of a more chronic illness, or perhaps that's the experience of mental health, or with children with sensory processing difficulty, those all impact on a person's ability to be able to do what they want to do. Mm-hmm. So the core piece is about looking at the person, the strengths and skills they have, the environment they're living in, and the things they want to do.
So if people want to engage with either of your projects, or, you know, look for an occupational therapist in their area, do they just go to the Association of Occupational Therapy's website?
That's a good question. So it depends, Claire. So depends on where they are. So a child with a complex need would need to go through a referral to referred to a children's disability network team. So that would come from their GP. There are children that are served in primary care services as well. So again, it's a referral from their GP. There are private practitioners that also work in paediatric therapy services as well. They can resource them on the AOTI website. So it really depends. So whether it's adult, child, disability, so it's diverse.
It's the same with us in terms of mental health. We are that, I suppose, a secondary tertiary services referral through your GP to access community mental health services. Our particular services is for people who are with experience of homelessness in the Dublin North inner city, but I am part of a wider community mental health service. So there are OTs working on those teams.
So the GP is perhaps your first port of call, but if you want to find out more information about the Association of Occupational Therapists, you can go to AOTI.ie. Sarah Quinn, Assistant Professor in the Discipline of Occupational Therapists in Trinity College Dublin. Leonie Boland, Clinical Specialist Occupational Therapist with the HSE Programme for the Homeless in Dublin North City Mental Health Service. And Miriam Creenan, Senior Occupational Therapist with the Children's Disability Network Team in Kilkenny. Sounds like, award or no, you're doing fantastic work. So congratulations on that, and thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Claire.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you.
And Sarah and Leonie really want to also give thanks to Focus Ireland and Volunteer Ireland for helping with their project. Right, coming up after the break, psychologist Alison Keating on her brilliant book, It's All Too Much, How to Manage Anxiety and Panic Attacks.
Alive and Kicking on News Talk.
And you're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, psychologist Alison Keating has been a voice to help people understand themselves better for many years through her client work in the Be Well Clinic in Dublin, as well as Ireland AM, writing for the Irish Independent, podcasts, and indeed back on my very first radio gig at Dublin Station Spin. Alison was always our go-to for her level of expertise distilled down into easy-to-understand language and practical advice. Well, that style of hers continues in her brilliant second book, It's All Too Much. And Alison joins me in studio now. Alison, you're very welcome.
Thank you for having me.
It's not the first time you've been on this show, but I'm delighted to have you here. And I loved this book. I learned so much because I think we talk about anxiety. People say, oh my God, I nearly had a panic attack there. We throw these terms around, as well as there being more of an openness and an understanding around mental health. But I don't think we have that deeper level of understanding of what's really going on.
And how would we? Like, how would we? You know, at the end of the day, it's really complicated. And yet our bodies are like immensely sophisticated. They know what they're doing, but sometimes what happens is our body gets stuck and acts in ways that feels like a complete betrayal to us, such as a panic attack. But there are real reasons why it has done what it's done to survive difficult times in your life or difficult situations. And your body doesn't forget. So it's just about I actually love psychology so much, and it really helps you understand yourself and understand other people. And like, a lot of the premise in the book is polyvagal theory, which is only 20 years old. So this is the science of safety, which most people don't know about because it's very complicated. So what I wanted to do was just to present it in a way that you had enough information, but you didn't need to be an expert on it. I didn't want to overload people with, you know, the neurological underpinnings of it, because it's really, really complicated. But if we come back to kind of trusting ourselves, it's a really different experience, even though life is still chaotic.
And talk to us a little bit about your first job in this area. You had a bit of a crossroads in life where you could kind of take two different paths, and you chose a path to work with particularly traumatized people.
So I had, like, it was my first major job, and I had a choice of working within an organizational setting or work as an organizational psychologist or working with people who were seeking asylum in Ireland. So what we found was that obviously a lot of people were traumatized. So when that role came up, I was like, oh, that sounds fantastic. Because I just felt it was something I was very drawn towards, because it was something that I had, you know, studied a lot in terms of trauma. And that work was phenomenal. It really was. It was incredible because it also gave me an understanding of the impact that trauma has upon the body. So even no matter if someone was trying to be strong or trying to get over something, your body, as I said, it just doesn't lie. It holds on to that fear and that trauma. And I just thought this is what I want to do. And it also gave me a perspective of life that has never really changed from that point. And it's not to minimize other people's experiences, but to go, my God, people are incredibly able to cope with the most horrific things that you could ever imagine. So it gave me a perspective of the incredible strength that people possess and our survival instinct, which is really the premise of the book, is, you know, in terms of why we have to sometimes survive. And I suppose if we take that example of working with trauma, you know, people who were seeking asylum in Ireland at the time, and they had experienced huge trauma. They'd been persecuted. They were prisoners of war. They would explain the type of torture they endured and the fear that if they were sent back home, they would actually be killed. And that perspective just gave me an understanding of the real life stories of what it was actually like for people. Whereas I suppose in our current environment, what was different then was obviously they were clients. So I was holding this myself and working through it with my supervisor. But as I look around the world now, I'm like, we can all see what's going on. So it's a very it was an interesting place to start. And it wasn't even a crossroads. Like, obviously, parents and things were like, go for the good pensionable job. And I was like, oh, no, this looks much more up my alley. And I just find that type of work gives so much meaning and purpose to everything that I do. But it also has inspired me as a person to know that people can come through the most enormous and difficult situations.
And I liked what you said there, because it's not to minimise anybody's experience, whether it's finding parenting stressful or work life stressful. You know, that we can't say, well, look, we're not in a war-torn country and keep going, because that's the problem. We don't stop and take the measures to try and help ourselves in these situations. And that's why the stress builds.
I think that's actually really important to note. And that's why I talk in the book about first world problems, and that we're so like self-deprecating about it, and that we minimize our own experiences. And what we have is small T and big T. So big T is the big trauma, such as war, persecution, rape, you know, all the big things that we know about. But we don't connect as much with the small T. And small T, if you're alive, you've experienced some level of trauma. And I think that when we minimize our experience, especially in the first world, and when we look at the statistics of our physical and mental health, they don't bode well in the first world. So I think it's really important that the book is a book of compassion, that actually how we're living in the first world, I think, is causing us enormous anxiety. And that's really what I feel like after like 25 years of work experience. I'm thinking, well, I don't see why people, I don't know how people can't actually be anxious, because it's not just you. It's not just, and even with the information overload, like, you know, just this constant shovel of self-care. You know, you tell that to an exhausted parent, you know, if you just do this, it's another thing that we're failing at. And I just think the pressure and the amount of information our brains have to absorb is enormous. And what I found interesting whilst talking about the book is that in certain interviews, people have said to me, and I completely understand where they're coming from, you know, well, was it not worse in the 80s? You know, what actually is the difference? But the difference is technology now, it comes into our homes. There was a part, and I don't think it's ever good in comparing different times, because they're just completely different. There were different problems then, and we have just different problems now. So I think it's just to kind of stand back and go, is how I'm living my life aligned with how I actually would like it to be? I think most people kind of feel, and this isn't about achievement, but just about having some space and time to think. It's that relentless nature of just everything back to back. You know, it's just, where's the space and where's the joy? And something I would, you know, naturally talk about in therapy would be how people's childhood was. But I genuinely am wondering how people's adulthood is going. And not that it's joyful or happy all the time. I don't actually advocate for that at all. But is there space where it feels aligned to you? And how's your nervous system within that? Like, people might think, oh, I'm fine. But then, are you wrecked? Are you really, really tired? How are your energy levels? How's your patience, you know, in terms of how you relate to your loved ones? What I also see, Claire, a lot is high functioning anxiety. So people doing really great in their careers and killing it in that. But then they're basically just fit to drop on the couch when they get home. And then they don't, like, say you're in a family situation. Then they're like, I don't have that capacity. I'm already at full capacity. And now I have to go into basically the second shift, and I'm showing up in a way I don't actually want to show up. So I just think the way we're living isn't normal. And I just want to question that and kind of come in and just gently push against the concept of what we value in terms of this hyper-productivity, always having to be doing, even in socializing. Like, if someone turned around and says, what did you do the weekend? And I said nothing. Like, oh God, really? You know?
Yeah. And, you know, I know you're saying don't compare, but I do think in previous generations, they were happy to live a more simple life. I mean, I don't think my parents were out in the same way we aspire to be out. Like, there's just this constant need to be doing something. And, you know, in the book, and I've listened to some of your interviews promoting the book, when you look at what we've been through in the last few years, I mean, the pandemic went straight into war in Ukraine, straight into Gaza, climate change, crisis here in our own country, be it the housing crisis, cost of living crisis. There's a lot. It is all too much. And what really surprised me is we kind of know this, but we're not 100% sure how we can turn it off. And when you delve into people who are high functioning with anxiety or who are experiencing panic attacks, it does come after us at some point. If we don't deal with it in a preventative way or catch it, it is going to come for us. We're going to have to deal with it at some point.
Yeah. And I suppose that sounds scary, doesn't it? That it's coming for us. What I would say is I invite it in. So like when I'm in session with someone, I imagine the other the other kind of characters coming in to session and I invite them in. So if someone's really frustrated and angry, I nearly invite that into the couch and I go, let's just bring anger in here. I'm very glad of Inside Out because I use, like, I get them to visualize, like, did you see the movie? Yeah, I did. Like, imagine anger coming in here and they've got, you know, it's coming out of their head. And I think a lot of people will relate to that sense of constant frustration. You know, before you get up out of bed, you already feel like you're behind and it's that never enough. And as you said, those expectations sometimes are just through the roof in all aspects of our lives and what we expect of ourselves and even of others. I don't ever think we can go back to that simpler life, but I think we have to just ask, well, where am I now? You know, and the book in my mind is basically like an inner GPS. And that came from that I basically have no sense of direction. Like I could get lost in the studio if I wanted to, genuinely. And I was like, wouldn't it be useful if we took the I shouldn't feel like this, because that's what I hear in session all the time. So people feel like, well, I have a house and I have a family and I shouldn't feel as bad as I do. Like I should be grateful. And that really plays at people. But I'm like, okay, but you can't sleep. But you find it impossible to sit down and relax. You're arguing with your spouse all of the time. You feel really impatient. You're racked with guilt. You are having panic attacks. And they're like, yeah, I know, but I shouldn't feel this way. So there's where the first world problems comes in and knocks out our ability to connect because we look around and go, well, it's so much worse everywhere else. And I just think, again, we can't compare. Like, of course it's dreadful. Then the question I'd ask is, well, what can you do about it? Can you do something to help? Rather than to sit back and feel, I think there's a lot of hopelessness around at the moment, especially this week. You know, there's kind of like, oh my God, we're heading into a next thing, you know, in terms of the election and just the value system of the whole world. So bringing it back to yourself and finding and questioning without any judgment, this is where I am at the moment. I feel a bit lost, confused, overwhelmed, not like myself. Where do I actually want to be? I just actually want to feel a little bit more able to switch off. Because I think people go all the way to peace. And I don't actually agree with that because it's this all or nothing thinking that I don't think takes in the nuance of life. You know, like even before we started, you're chatting about all the different things happening in all the different roles in your life. And that's the reality of life. Like there's always stuff being thrown at us, unexpected things. You know, I had one kid home from school. She's like, shuffle, shuffle, change, change. You know what I mean? You're always constantly pivoting. And I think that psychological flexibility is a really good skill because when we expect things to go the way we want them to and when they don't, that really plays into anxiety, definitely.
Yeah, and I think people kind of think, but how can everything change? Because nothing is going to change. I'm still going to be busy. I'm still going to have all these life responsibilities. But actually, you know, to counteract what I said about the scary, it's coming for you.
Yeah.
People can come through the toughest of times. And often when you have somebody come to you for advice, it's because they've hit that rock bottom or they've had that panic attack. Mm-hmm. And something that I didn't know from until I read the book was that it can happen in the most seemingly calming of situations. I thought panic attacks came when people were panicking.
No.
They can be watching, you know, a movie at home on the couch and it can happen.
I'm genuinely curious at this point that it's the same story I've heard again and again, that it's happened on the couch and that they weren't thinking of anything. And I sometimes wonder, is it that the nervous system actually is kind of calm and relaxed in that moment? And it's actually safe to have the panic attack, if that makes sense. None of this is conscious. So I liken it to the post-school meltdown. The kids been good all day long. They've sat in their chair. They haven't moved. They've listened. They've done what they're told. And then they get in the car and the teacher said, they're a great kid. And then they get in the car and the mask comes off. So I think at an unconscious level, the panic attack on the couch is the same thing, that actually you have the space for it to come up. But it has absolutely come from somewhere. Everyone says it came out of nowhere because they were sitting on the couch and that felt really odd. They're like, I can't believe this happened in this situation. Like say people say about fear of flying, they're always like, I'm terrified it'll happen on the plane. That doesn't happen. Like people might sit in the chair and be white knuckled, you know, and have a very silent panic attack. But, you know, it's that sense of being trapped in a situation like a plane or a train where you would feel out of control. Whereas I think the home panic attack is our body going, okay, I have to face this now, but you are not intentionally bringing it there. So I genuinely think panic attacks are the smack across the face. I think they're the same kind of function as someone fainting. So it's like not enough oxygen to the brain, we start again. And the panic attack is the bit that gets people to come in and get some help, because there may have been anxiety there beforehand for years and years and years, but people just keep putting it off, going, that was a really tough period, you know, this was happening, that person was ill, I was losing my job, whatever was going on. And then each time you go through those phases, you go, ah, that was just a tough time. But each time it's really pernicious. That's what that's horrible about anxiety, is it nibbles away at your sense of self, it nibbles away at your confidence. And when that panic attack comes, it rips the rug from under your feet, because you're like, oh my God, I'm actually dying. Like most people genuinely think they're full out dying. And I suppose it's good when they've gone to, say, hospital and the person has said, this is a panic attack. And they're like, no, it couldn't be. And I think people nearly feel upset and scared leaving, because they're like, no, something's really wrong with me, and they actually have missed it.
You have practical advice for people in the midst of a panic attack. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a couple of pointers on that, although you delve deeply in the book?
Yeah. So say, for example, I think it's nice to break it down. Say you are actually at home and you're having a panic attack, or someone else is having a panic attack. Two ice cubes. And it's absolutely phenomenal. You put an ice cube in each hand and you hold them in the palm of your hand. And it gives such a kind of a physiological shock that it distracts your body in that moment. So you're kind of up in your mind at that moment, and you're in fight or flight at that stage. And your body's preparing. It's in survival mode. It thinks something dreadful is actually happening, even if you are safe. But the ice cubes just give that kind of immediate break. I've seen someone actually literally come out of a panic attack in it. It's not just hypothetical. And even they were like, oh. Like we actually, it kind of went into a quick laugh. It was like, whoa, how did that happen? So it's really good to know that. Obviously, I'm being specific that if you're at home, that one's useful, because you're not going to have ice cubes walking around, you know, in general terms. But say if you're out, I think, and if you know you've had a panic attack before, the anticipatory anxiety is a really big issue for people, because they have the fear of the fear. And then they start with what if. Not that I encourage cursing at home, but like, you know, some words slip out with the kids. And I say the worst language in my house is what if. Stop that. You're not allowed to say what if. You know that. And if you want to have a panic attack, start with what if. And that's what happens. And I imagine like dominoes all stacked up, right? And you start with, well, what if I, you know, say someone's giving a presentation at work. What if my throat dries up, or all of a sudden I haven't a single thought in my brain? What if I collapse and faint? And I want people to know that you won't faint having a panic attack. Okay, everyone thinks they will, but your body is in a physiological state that's the complete opposite of what happens when you faint. But even knowing that is like a safety kind of valve for you to kind of go, okay, I feel like I'm going to faint, but I'm actually not going to faint. Now, look, if you are experiencing sudden, and I suppose that's the thing with a panic attack, what is it? It's a sudden onset and it comes out of nowhere. That's what's so shocking about it. But if you have any medical experience, it's sudden and very strong physically, I would say, like, absolutely check it out with your doctor, go to the hospital. And then when you get the clearance, then we start working with what's actually, what has led to this point. But I think it's important to know that you don't ignore something very physical. So yeah, and then if you're, say if you're at work, like say if you're having a panic attack, just go into the bathroom and put the, roll up your sleeves, put the water past your wrists. Just give yourself a moment, do the 4x4 breathing. So you breathe in for 4, you hold for 4, you breathe out for 4, you hold for 4. Or you do what you can. Because what happens is the person is over breathing, and that's what sends the signal to the brain, oh, it's time to panic. So you might feel a rush of adrenaline up your legs. That's what it actually is. You might feel tingling in your fingertips. It's such a physical thing. But if you think about it, that has come from sometimes, say, with the anticipatory anxiety, you can go, oh, I had a panic attack here before. And then any physiological symptoms, you become hyper aware of. So it's just about recognizing, here's the panic dominoes. Every step I take here is pulling it out and stopping the chain of events, because people feel like it happens and it's completely outside of your control. So those kind of basic things where you put some cold water on yourself, where you, I think a really important one, and I said this the other day, like I have like a little panic attack survival kit that you can have in your bag, and it's a good one for kids as well. Pack of crackers, a banana, and sour jellies. And sour jellies, again, they give that kind of strong, you know, distraction, because distraction is very good with anxiety. I know normally psychologists are saying distraction is bad, but with anxiety, you want to distract. Think of your dominoes, you want to distract. You want to keep interjecting and, you know, and what I like about dominoes is that, for me, kind of metaphorically, doesn't matter how many times it keeps going, you can keep doing something. And that's why I created the psychological toolbox, because what works for one person is going to work differently for someone else. And you've got to figure out, well, it's like a little recipe. Like, I liked that one. That one definitely helped me with the panic attack. And then you find you're in a different situation and that doesn't work, then you try something else. So it's just building that confidence back up, that no matter what actually happens, you can bring yourself back from it. And I think kind of a statement, a calming statements are really helpful as well. So I have a little script where you actually say to yourself, this is a panic attack. I'm having a panic attack. I am safe, even though I don't feel safe. This is a panic attack. So just in that moment, knowing that you're having a panic attack is so helpful, rather than thinking, oh my God, I'm actually having a heart attack and I'm dying, or I'm losing it. A lot of people really think they're losing their mind in that moment. And that's a terrifying experience.
Well, like you say, you do delve into it so well in the book, kind of diving under the bonnet as to what's going on, as well as into each toolbox, so people can pack their own and find really what works for them. And, you know, I think as well, people have an idea in their head of an anxious person being a particular way. I didn't even know till I read the book about fight, flight, freeze or fawn, that people can just check out of life and kind of float around. But that's anxiety in itself. And I think that's why people can get so surprised. I could literally talk to you all day. I cannot recommend this book enough, whether you have anxiety or not. I think we're all feeling under pressure. I think it's well worth it. But it will be a great support if there is somebody in your life, or it's you, who has experienced panic attacks, overwhelm and anxiety. It's called It's All Too Much: Practical Ways to Pause Panic Attacks, Reduce Overwhelm and Anxiety, and Rediscover Everyday Joy. Alison Keating, the Practical Psychologist on Instagram. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
So that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aidan McKelvey, and to Hugo Da Silva Scott, who was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.